From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the psychological effects of violence in the Middle East. We talk with two psychiatrists who are also active in the peace movement, one in Gaza, the other in Tel Aviv. Dr. Iyad El-Siraj is director of the Gaza Community Health Program, a nonprofit, non-governmental Palestinian agency. He's an advocate of nonviolence who is constantly dealing with the aftermath of violence. Dr. Ruchama Martin has a private practice in Tel Aviv. She founded the Israeli chapter of Physicians for Human Rights. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Danielle Irby. Robert Mueller promises to restore the public's confidence to the nation's leading enforcement agency if he's chosen to lead it. Mueller, President Bush's nominee to head the FBI, acknowledged the agency is far from perfect during his confirmation hearing today before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Mueller also warned that the next FBI director faces significant management and administrative challenges. The next FBI head will also have to deal with greater oversight by Congress. Judiciary Chairman Patrick Leahy said Congress will take a hands-on approach until the Bureau's problems are solved. Conservative Democrats in the House have started collecting signatures on a petition to force debate on a campaign finance bill. Reformers pulled the bill from the floor earlier this month in the face of strong opposition from House Republican leaders. NPR's Peter Overby has more.
The discharge petition, as it's called, comes from a group of conservative Democrats known as the Blue Dogs. Jim Turner of Texas submitted the petition and was first to sign it. Steve Horn, a moderate Republican from California, then added his name. The reformers will need the support of Democrats and moderate Republicans to succeed. Now they're launching a big push to collect signatures before the House begins its August recess. Officially, the magic number is 218, a majority of the House. But unofficially, fewer than that could do. In 1998 and again in 1999, House leaders let a campaign finance bill come to the floor when they realized a discharge petition was picking up momentum. A spokesman for House Speaker Dennis Hastert says the speaker is focused on other things this busy legislative week, not on campaign finance reform. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli helicopter gunships attacked the Palestinian police headquarters in Gaza today, this after two bombings in Jerusalem in the past 24 hours. NPR's Linda Gradstein is in Jerusalem.
Witnesses said the helicopters fired at least three rockets at the building that is the main police headquarters in Gaza, injuring seven policemen. Smoke billowed over densely populated Gaza City. An Israeli army spokeswoman said the building hit had been used as a factory to manufacture bombs and mortars. The Israeli attack seemed a fulfillment of Israel's promise that it would retaliate for every Palestinian attack. Earlier today, a Palestinian stabbed an ultra-Orthodox Israeli in Jerusalem's Old City, and a small bomb in a beer can exploded in a downtown Jerusalem grocery store. Last night, a car bomb blew up in an underground parking lot on the outskirts of Jerusalem. There were no casualties in either bombing. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The UN Security Council has unanimously adopted a resolution authorizing the deployment of UN monitors. They will help carry out sanctions against Afghanistan's Taliban rulers. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 15 points to 10,401. This is NPR. Authorities are investigating the cause of yesterday's deadly tractor explosion at a county fair in Ohio. Dozens of people were injured. April Baer with member station WCPN reports from Cleveland.
The flag is flying at half staff today in front of the grandstand at the Medina County Fair, but vendors are open for business as usual. This morning's official opening was delayed by 2 hours as fair officials tried to piece together what caused a steam-powered tractor to burst, raining shrapnel and hot oil in about a 100-yard radius, as exhibitors prepared for opening day at one of Ohio's oldest and largest county expositions. At this point, officials are focusing their investigation on the possible failure of an escape valve or some other kind of safety device. The Medina County Sheriff says it's unlikely anyone will be charged in the incident, but the remains of the 83-year-old tractor will be examined. Of those still hospitalized, some are in serious condition, others are under observation. For NPR News, I'm April Baer in Cleveland.
The United States is threatening to boycott the UN Conference on Racism if reparations for slavery are given a high priority. Planners of the conference to take place next month in Durban, South Africa, want to include discussions of reparations for descendants of slaves in the U.S. alongside a resolution equating Zionism with racism. A pair of power converters is causing trouble for NASA again in its efforts to launch a new solar probe. Genesis was scheduled to be launched today, but now the space agency says the launch will be put off at least until Wednesday. Last week, NASA discovered that two similar converters failed after being exposed to high radiation levels during testing. I'm Danielle Irby, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians escalates, we're going to talk with two psychiatrists about how the conflict is affecting the mental health of the people on both sides. Both psychiatrists are active in the peace movement, but they're constantly dealing with the fallout of hatred, fear, and violence. Later we'll hear from Dr. Ruchama Martin in Tel Aviv. My first guest is Dr. Iyad El-Siraj, the founding director of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program. He was the first practicing psychiatrist in Gaza. He founded the Community Mental Health Program in 1990 during the First Intifada, the uprising against the Israeli occupation. He's also the former Commissioner General of the Palestinian Independent Commission for Citizens' Rights. I asked Dr. Siraj to describe some of the typical mental health problems he sees on a daily basis.
A typical case of today is a case of a young boy who is around 12 and who started bedwetting very recently, although he has been dry for the last 9 years or so. And the bedwetting today is due to the acute cause is the trauma, being subjected to some kind of severe blast of Israeli bombs or terrible scene in the TV of people being shot or killed in blood, or being harassed here and there, and or through the fear coming from the eyes of his mother or his father, who are usually terrified and in a state of panic, unable to protect their children. Children usually ask, why don't you have a gun, father? How are you going to protect me if the Israelis are going to shoot, if the Israeli soldiers are going to do something? How are you going to protect me? So the father is usually helpless, and the mother is in a state of panic, and then the end result is a child who is bedwetting, sometimes unable to concentrate in the school, sometimes unable to behave well, and sometimes violent.
So what can you do for the 12-year-old boy who's wetting his bed?
Well, you see, we have different ways of, and sometimes we mix them together. But the basic thing is to make the child understand why it is happening to him, and to make the family understand why is it happening to a child, and then how to cope with this. The minute you have the insight as a child into this problem, then you actually have 50% chance of improvement. And the other methods we use are behavioral conditioning, and then we also sometimes use medications. But it has to be all done in the context of the family setting, where really people understand why is it happening to them, and the child should understand why is it happening to him. Without this, it can go on for a long time.
What's another typical problem you're seeing at the Gaza Community Mental Health Program?
Well, it is a woman who has lost somebody recently, or has one of her children wounded, or the husband is not working and the burden is falling onto her at home to try and cope with all the difficulties and stresses, and suddenly she could not cope anymore, and she started to complain of continuous headaches, numbing feeling in the scalp of her head, burning sensation in the back of her head, sometimes suffocation feelings, that she feels suffocated, she needs air, and different other symptoms. And then she goes to the doctor, and the doctor gives her some medication, some tranquilizers. It doesn't work. Then they refer to us. And then she comes. She doesn't know why she's being seen by a psychiatrist or psychologist. But then within few, perhaps six sessions, she will understand why is it happening to her. And it is related to some recent kind of trauma that she was subjected to.
What's your diagnosis usually in a case like that?
It's a depressive reaction. Most of the people in our part of the world, when they feel depressed, they don't say, "I am depressed." They don't have that kind of psychological language, but they have a body language. And usually depression is expressed in somatic and physical forms like headaches and chest pain and suffocation and so many other things.
How do you describe depression to a person who's depressed but isn't familiar with the concept?
Well, we don't try to put our language and vocabulary, which we learn in the West, for the people, but we try to understand the local expression of different illnesses, including depression. And we try to adjust our own learning and teaching into the culture. And, of course, depression is depression everywhere in the world. The way the difference is the way people express it. And then we try to introduce some new vocabulary into the patient dictionary and by suggesting things. But, you know, in many cases, it doesn't work. What works with the people still is the body and how the body is functioning in the case of depression and how is it improving if there is any improvement. The body is important.
So what language do you use? You say you need to find a cultural way of describing depression, whether it would be comprehensible in the culture. So what are some of the things you'll say to explain it or describe it?
Usually it is a talk about feelings on the body, different places in the body, particularly the head and the chest and the abdomen. And then, of course, we move on to, and in the sessions, to describe different other feelings, not the bodily feelings as such, but thoughts and emotions and so on. And of course, all these are expressed in a local Arabic colloquial language that is only understood by an Arab who lives in the area, really. I mean, sometimes even people who, Arabs who come from other places cannot understand it. This is very local kind of accent and kind of colloquial language.
Have you seen young people in Gaza who you consider to be would-be suicide bombers, who have gotten to the point where they're ready to sacrifice their life for the cause that they believe in?
You see, the people in Palestine, as much as in Israel, are preoccupied with the political upheaval and with the situation today that has engulfed the whole area with violence and repercussions, including children, of course. And from the children talk and drawings and painting and the way they express themselves, they are largely preoccupied with blood, with bodies, with ambulances, with fire alarms, with machine guns, with bombs, with airplanes. And there is a need for them to feel that they are doing something for the country. I mean, this is a culture that is refusing the defeat. And the way to get a sense of moral victory is like this. If the Israelis are able to kill, and they have the power of the F-16, then we have the power to die. And that is a very serious message. And sometimes it is transmitted to the minds of the children that death in the cause of God, in the cause of the land, in the cause of liberation, is glorified. You are dying because you're going to help your country and your people. And some children have this image of the suicide bomber as a hero who is sacrificing himself for the sake of us. And it is like a hero. It is like an example to follow. And some of them express that in sometimes saying it. But of course, it doesn't mean that they're going to do it. That's a different story.
So you believe in nonviolence. But if a young person comes to your center and they're really angry and they've been angry for years and they want to go on, say, a suicide mission, or they want to throw rocks at Israeli police, what do you tell them about your belief in nonviolence?
Well, I don't impose my beliefs on my clients, of course, but I always try to allow them to express themselves freely in any way and manner they think is right. And once they express themselves, we go into a discussion sometimes. And I suggest questions like, what happens if we do this? What do you think if we do that? And so on. But I never say to my clients, how do I feel myself about things? But I only suggest things and from one alternative to the other. It is for people to decide for themselves. Not me. I cannot decide for everyone, of course. But I write publicly, I publish in the Arab local press, and I always urge people around me, my staff and my people and my friends and everywhere, to think of the serious consequences of a Palestinian using any form of armed resistance and violent resistance against the Israelis, because violence will not make us win. I believe that violence is now, it's, you know, the picture in the West is like two armies are fighting. The two violent people are doing, but it is not, of course, totally untrue. The true thing is that we live under the Israeli military occupation and people want to have their freedom. But they resist by throwing rocks or by shooting. And the Israeli reaction to that is massive. Destruction of homes and bulldozing groves and killing people and sending F-16s, massive reaction to Palestinian attempt to resist violently. So I believe that is wrong. Politically, it is wrong. From the human rights point of view, it is wrong to kill anybody. And I believe in the sanctity of life. And the way to protect life is by protecting the life of others.
My guest is Dr. Iyad El-Siraj, founder of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Dr. Iyad El-Siraj. He's the founder and director of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, and he's a psychiatrist. You started the Community Mental Health Program in Gaza during the first Intifada in, what, around 1987, is that right?
That's right. And then 1990 I started.
You started in 1990?
But Intifada was in 1987, sorry.
Okay. What were your reasons for starting it?
Well, the reason, at that time I was a practicing psychiatrist in England. At that time, although I lived in Gaza and practiced for some time, but the reason was exactly because of the Intifada and the number of people I saw at that time and kept receiving information about Palestinian children being traumatized, you know, at that time. It was really an intifada of children and youngsters, witnessing beating of the fathers and elderly and so on. So I decided when I was in England that this is the place I should go to, and I should be helpful to my own people and their masses. And when we started then, I was the only psychiatrist for the whole of Gaza Strip. And I felt that I was needed there more than anywhere else in the world.
You said that you're against violence and that you think nonviolence is the solution. You've seen a lot of people trying to deal with their anger, anger at the Israeli occupation. And their anger is sometimes expressed through violence, whether that's throwing rocks or becoming a suicide bomber. How do you deal with your anger?
Well, I deal with my anger through understanding myself, motives and emotions and thoughts, and always have 1 hour every day at least only for myself to think about what did I do today and what was wrong, what was right. I go to the beach of Gaza every morning. I go for a long walk, and then I go for a good swim. I read. I have friends who are very supportive, and some of them are also psychologists and psychiatrists who work with me, and we have kind of support to each other. So I deal with my anger, and sometimes, you know, I advise people to use sport. Sport can really take so much of your own inner violence out in a constructive manner. The other way is to be constructive in so many ways. I remember one day in the first Intifada, I was so angry, faced by an arrogant Israeli soldier who tried to abuse me in the street. I was so angry. I went home, and then I decided to sweep the streets in which I was living in. And that helped me so much. To be constructive is the way out, I think.
You want to see people on both sides as human beings, and you want people on both sides to see each other as human beings instead of just seeing them as the enemy. You were imprisoned, I believe, for 17 days in 1996, imprisoned in Gaza by the Palestinian Authority, and this was after criticizing the authority in an article in the New York Times in which you were quoted. What was it like for you to be in prison? And I think you were beaten by guards there. What was it like to understand the roots of violence as a psychiatrist, and yet to be the victim of that violence, wanting to see the people abusing you as human beings, and yet, you know, here they are abusing you. So you must have been going through a lot of very complicated thoughts and feelings. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what went through your mind.
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, I was subjected to harsh treatment, beating, and then I was taken into an underground solitary cell. Was suffocating, and it affected me so much, that kind of experience. But then you have to deal with that, and I dealt with that, and I believe that I went back to normality again with the help of some of my colleagues, of course. Now, the thing is, you see, if you allow anger to take over, then you actually destroy yourself. Not only others, but you destroy yourself. So one should really deal with anger. And I actually, at one stage, some people urged me to try and get my revenge out of the people who have beaten me. But I said, no, I have no individual vendetta against persons. I have no anger left against them. I totally forgive them. But I don't forget the system. I don't forgive the people in the system who ordered the beating, as they much did order the beating of others and torture of others that led to even the death of people in detention. And this is the thing that we have to, this is the constructive way, is to campaign always for the rule of law, for the respect of human dignity, for the respect of human rights. I think it helped me when I continued to go into my work in that way, to be constructive.
When you were being beaten, did you say to yourself, how can I engage the people who are beating me in a conversation so that they can see my humanity and maybe they'll stop? Or did you think, that's a pointless exercise, that's never going to happen, I won't even bother to try?
Well, I could not try with the people who actually beat me, because they did that in 6 or 7 minutes of beating, and then they just disappeared. But I tried it with other people, the guards, and I tried it very well with the inmates. You know, I was in that cell, and then I was moved to another place, which was full with Hamas people, who were at that time jailed by the Palestinian authorities. And I had a fantastic time with them, talking about nonviolence, talking about human rights, talking about psychology and mental health. And they were extremely nice to me, and they were very, very protective, knowing that I was really always screaming and shouting for the uphold of their human rights and not to have them in jail without charges, without courts, without the rule of law. And since then, actually, I started a training program for police officers and for security officers and for interrogators in our Gaza community mental program. We train scores of these people on issues of human rights and the effects of torture on people. And we visit them routinely, and we talk to them. And I must report to you here that since the time of my detention and my beating onwards, there is so much improvement in the behavior of the Palestinian Authority vis-a-vis the human rights.
Dr. Iyad El-Sirraj is founder of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Dr. Iyad El-Sirraj, director of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, and we talk with Israeli psychiatrist and peace activist Dr. Ruchama Martin. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about mental health in the face of violence in the Middle East. My guest is Dr. Iyad El-Sarraj. He's a psychiatrist who founded the Gaza Community Mental Health Program in 1990 during the First Intifada. He's a peace activist who advocates nonviolence. You have written, "I grew up in an environment that made me hate Jews." Elaborate on that.
Well, I grew up in an environment in which everybody knew that we Palestinians became refugees in 1948 when Israel was established by Jews who came from Europe, and they have made the small army, evicted people, took the land from us. And the image of a Jew at that time in my head, I've never seen a Jew in my life. When I was up to the age of 12, perhaps, the image was a horrible monster who came from somewhere and took my house in Beersheba and took our land, and we ended up refugees in Gaza, and these people are murderers and killers. And that was the image that is everywhere. And Zionism was kind of the worst kind of name you can call anybody, bad name, you know, Zionists and so on. And that was the atmosphere in which I lived until I met some of the Jews, and for my shocking experience.
From your what experience?
It was shocking for me.
It was shocking experience.
Shocking revelation to discover that they are actually human beings.
Now you've said that when you were 12 and Israel occupied Gaza in 1956, someone named Moshe came to your door and asked for your father. Who was he?
Oh, yes. You read that article. It was a friend of my father. They apparently grew together in Jaffa, which is now part of Israel. At that time, my father was working in Jaffa and living there. And his neighbors were a Jewish family. And Moshe was about my father's age. And of course, in 1948, at that time, my father was working in Beersheba. We were evicted from there, and we came to Gaza, and we lived there. But between 48 and 56, there were no communication because Gaza became under the control of the Egyptians, and Israel was created, and there were borders, and no, that was the enemy, no more. In 56, when Israel invaded Egypt with Britain and France at that time, Israel occupied Gaza. And then that Moshe found a chance, an opportunity to come and ask about his friend Rajab, my father, after all these years. What is happening to him? Is he still alive? And what happened to the family and so on? And this is how it happened. I was in that day in the garden, and then this gate was banged, and Moshe was there, and it was a fantastic experience for me. Of course, I was surprised that my father would hug and kiss a Jew and then cry with him and so on. But then later I realized what friendship really means for people. And I'll never forget that.
How did your father and Moshe end up being friends in the first place?
Well, they were working in Jaffa. They were living in Jaffa. They were there. Moshe is a Palestinian, although he's a Jewish, but he lived and was born in Palestine and for generations, and they were living like neighbors. And my father's family at that time were living in Jaffa, and they grew up together. They were visiting each other and so on. So they became friends, and they continued to be friends, and I was amazed to see them in their reunion.
As a person who believes in nonviolence, do you have a lot of friends or even colleagues who think that you're crazy?
Yes, I do. Well, I have a lot of people and friends who we have mutual respect and kind of understanding. And I have so many people who support what I say. But of course, some people believe that I'm out of line with the mainstream. See, the problem is that today, because of the tension and so much anger on both sides, I think the place is being hijacked by the extremists. And in some way or another, they intimidate the moderate, the reasonable, the sane people into submission and not to express themselves freely. I believe that if we allow extremists on both sides to decide for our future, and we are absolutely wrong, we should do it today. And the way to do it is not violent. It should be in a way that is peaceful. That doesn't mean that we surrender our rights. On the contrary, nonviolence makes us stronger and it will give us our rights. But I believe that our best ally, our best friend, should be in Israel itself and in the Jewry of this world. And the way to make them understand, you see, to make my own Palestinian friend to understand, is saying to them, look to what happened in South Africa. The blacks' movement would not win without the whites joining them. And let us have a Palestinian peace movement that is joined by Israelis so we can achieve peace, justice, and security for all. And some people think I am crazy, but many do believe I'm right, but they cannot say it publicly because they are somehow, they want to be, they don't want to be seen like away from the mainstream and away from the general emotional reactions of revenge and killing and so on and so on.
Well, what are the consequences of being outside of that?
Well, I mean, the ultimate thing is that you're going to be killed, of course. I mean, if some people have mentioned that to me. Well, I don't believe so. And even if that happens, I believe very strongly that you have to do what you have to do and you have to be honest to what you believe in. I'm not going to pretend that I hate Jews in order to satisfy some Palestinians or Arabs. I'm not going to say that Jews are right and Israel is right in order to satisfy the Israeli military occupation. So I will not be arrested or harassed. So no, I will say this. The Israeli occupation of Palestine is the root of evil, and the Palestinian violence is only enlarging this evil.
Dr. Iyad El-Siraj is the founding director of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program. Coming up, we talk with Dr. Ruchama Martin, a psychiatrist and human rights activist in Israel. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Ruchama Martin is a psychiatrist with a private practice in Tel Aviv. Like Dr. Iyad El-Siraj, who we just heard from, she's a peace activist. In fact, they recently did a speaking tour together in Canada. In 1988, during the Palestinian Intifada, Dr. Martin founded the Association of Israeli and Palestinian Physicians for Human Rights. She's now acting president of the association's successor, Physicians for Human Rights Israel. In the past 3 years, she's had fellowships at Harvard, the University of Chicago, and Radcliffe College. She says that the state of Israeli security is often manifested in the mental health of her patients. As an example, she told me about a woman who recently came to her office 4 or 5 times.
She's a mother of 2 daughters. And then in the neighborhood, there is a building built up, and the workers are Israeli Palestinians. And she came very upset and in a state of anxiety, telling me that she started to be very worried about those workers. I asked her what happened. She said, you know, till October, the last October, I was not worried at all, but now everything is changed. To my question, what really changed? She couldn't answer. She said, you know, this is politics. It's not me. It took a long time to elaborate what she is really worrying about. And she sees now, as many, many Israelis, the Palestinians as a collective enemy, no matter if they are Israeli Palestinians, as they are, those workers, or Palestinians from the occupied territories or elsewhere.
There's been several suicide bombings.
Yes.
In Israel. Can you feel the impact that that is having psychologically on people who are your patients or on people that you know as friends or people you meet in the street?
Most of the Israelis used to think that the state of Israel and the army are powerful, forceful, and they can beat the Palestinians. This, if I may say it in such simple words, this is the main feeling towards the Palestinians. They are not equal, and they can be defeated easily. When those suicidal bombers came into the Israeli cities, people were not prepared psychologically to deal with it. The concept of we are so mighty and they are so weak broke in a moment. And people are not prepared to deal with the new situation that leaves them without a kind of protection, of psychological protection from the army and from the government. So this give place to a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear, a lot of hatred to the Palestinians, and the demand to beat them harder, to activate the army in the most forceful way one can think. Just from the psychological point of view, to go back to the feeling that the IDF, the Israel army, the Israeli army is really mighty and can knock down the Palestinians.
Most of your patients are women. Do the women who you see ever talk with you about their concerns about how to deal with their children's anxiety about Israeli security, their children's fears that they will be attacked by Palestinians?
Yes, it's not very often, but it happened. One mother told me, for example, I lost my place among my children as the protector. They feel now that they have to protect me, to encourage me, to support me, because I am so frightened. I don't give them the permit to go to the malls, to go to the beach, even not to go to the cinema, to the movies. And they are trying to comfort me, to tell me that the situation is not so severe, it's not so grave, don't worry, and so on. And this set a kind of upside down of the normal, whatever it is, situation between this mother and her three children. So her question is what to do about it, which is a very hard one.
What advice do you give?
It's a long way to do, because there is no simple question answer to this question. I'm trying to see what is so frightening, and usually I'm finding that what's so frightening is the unpredictable situation, because she cannot No, of course she cannot know. Where will be the next bomb? And I cannot help her with it. But also she cannot know why those bombs are happening at all. And once she can see that there is a kind of continuation to one violence, which breeds or brings to another violence, it makes a kind of relief, not a total one, because still the normal fear of being killed or my loved one will be killed is very powerful, and there is no answer to that. But to the anxiety around it, that as if there is no logic, no reason to this Palestinian violence, that can be elaborated and worked through and give a kind of relief.
How often do you find yourself discussing politics with your patients?
Well, for me, you know, politics is almost everything. So this kind of differentiation between what our government is doing or the Palestinians are doing and what happens in everyday life or in the very inner life is not very clear. So I cannot deal with this question in a way because everything is coming and going from politics.
I have another question about your patients.
Yes.
I would assume some of the patients who you see are the children of Holocaust survivors.
Yes, second or third generation.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there's a certain group of problems that you see particularly among the children or the grandchildren of Holocaust survivors who now feel that they're living in an embattled society in Israel, who now feel that they're under potential attack.
One kind of reaction would be, I am going to try my best to eliminate wrongdoing. This is the lesson I have learned from history, from my parents' history or my grandparents' history. This is not a frequent. I can see more the opposite or the other kind of reaction, that people are thinking that only power, only force will solve the Israeli problem, that if you will not kill, you will be killed. Once you start to be weak, not to protect yourself, not to be suspicious, you will be exterminated like it was in the Second World War. And those people are becoming very militant.
Dr. Ruchama Martin is my guest. She's a psychiatrist in Tel Aviv. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Ruchama Martin, a psychiatrist in Tel Aviv and founder of Israeli and Palestinian Physicians for Human Rights. You are a human rights activist and a peace activist in Israel. You have worked with Palestinian doctors and with Israeli doctors.
Yes.
But I think it's probably fair to say that you are in a minority within your profession in terms of your political activism and your political point of view. Do many of your colleagues think that you're... that you're wrong and that you're behaving inappropriately by bringing your politics into your private practice.
Yes, I must say that what you said is very exact. Though proportionally, the Physicians for Human Rights in Israel are one of the biggest organizations in the West world, but still we are outsiders, a small minority, and our influence exists, but I wish that it was much, much bigger.
What are some of the criticisms that you get?
I can tell you an example. Like 4 months ago, it was in May this year, I was in Gaza, and the Israel radio, the national one, which is a good one, called me and asked me what do I see and so on. And I told them that, to my understanding, the settlers, I mean those people who are living in settlements in the occupied territories, Gaza or the West Bank, are irresponsible parents because they are endangering their children mentally and physically. And I would recommend to take those children back to the borders of Israel, to the Green Line, what we called. And it is a kind of preventive medicine for them. And it is much better to prevent harm than to try to cure it after it happened. The moment I came home, my answering machine was flooded with all kinds of threats, like, we will kill you, we will ruin your career, and all kinds of awful sexist words and sentences.
Who were the people making these threats?
Most of them, except one, because I can tell who is calling me, were people from the settlements, from the occupied territories. Except one, all of them were men. Only one woman was there. She was also from the settlements.
Have you had to deal with any of the uncertainty and anxiety and fear that your patients have had to deal with because of the escalation in hostilities between Palestinians and Israelis? Do you feel that you have more fear, anxiety to cope with as a result of that?
Matter of fact, no. First of all, I really trust my colleagues, Palestinian colleagues in the occupied territories. And then I'm going very often to the West Bank, less so to Gaza Strip because it's impossible now by the Israelis. I cannot get there. But when I never go alone. It's always that we are going like a group. When we are going there, I wish you could see the way people are welcoming us, the way we are treated so warmly. There is all kinds of policemen and security Palestinian people. So I cannot tell you exactly what kind are usually going with us just to give us a kind of good feeling of safetiness. And so I don't feel those fears. I can tell you that my children staying at home, they are really uncomfortable with me going there in a situation like this. So they are trying to stop me, by talking about it. Usually I don't give in and I'm going there.
Is there a difference between the way you feel you are treated by Palestinians when you go to the West Bank, as Dr. Ruhama Martin, the founder of Physicians for Human Rights, and when you're just walking down the street in Israel, or in the West Bank, and you pass Palestinians who know that you're Israeli and that you're Jewish, do you feel more hostility there when they don't know your personal history, when they don't know the work you've done, when you're just another Israeli, another Jewish Israeli?
Well, this thing does not happen to me. I'm not going to the occupied territories, means the West Bank or Gaza Strip, for pleasure or for shopping or for anything. When I'm going there, I'm going to do work. I wish I will go to the Palestinian state when it will be, as a tourist, as a citizen. But as long as I have to go there protected by the Israeli army, I don't wish to go there. And the other part of your question, if I'm walking in Tel Aviv Street and I see a Palestinian, well, one cannot see a Palestinian in Tel Aviv. First of all, they are not there. And then if one is coming as a suicidal bomb, he's disguised or trying to disguise himself so very well that I cannot recognize him. So on everyday basis, this question does not exist for me.
Dr. Ruchama Martin is a psychiatrist in Tel Aviv. She's founder of Israeli and Palestinian Physicians for Human Rights and acting president of the group's successor, Physicians for Human Rights Israel. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording featuring tenor saxophonist Harold Land. He died Friday at the age of 73. He first made his mark in the mid-50s, playing with trumpeter Clifford Brown and drummer Max Roach. Here they are together in 1954, playing Brown's Joy Spring.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Delta Trade Paperback, a division of Random House, publisher of Driving Mr. Albert, A Trip Across America with Einstein's Brain, a work of nonfiction by Michael Paternity. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Barry Hanna on why he writes about violence and the presence of evil. His new novel, his first in 10 years, is called Yonder Stands Your Orphan. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.